This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, let's get into it. There is the burning platform. It's something that comes at you every Thursday morning, and we get to discuss all the issues that are most pertinent in politics, in society, in the economy, and in the global situation that we find ourselves in. Every single week, it's brought to you by Nando's, because Nando's are not afraid to be controversial, as you've seen from their advertising. Neither are we. All right, so first things first, Canton Pele is here, Pumi Mashiko is here. It's become a bit of a Thursday club for us.
We love it.
Canton,
yeah, except last week you guys kind of had the Kumbaya edition without me around.
Well, you were busy. You had things to do.
Yeah, well, I was giving a talk to influential people, but
that's what you do here as well.
Yeah. Well done. Well, there was Pumi kind of doing her whole, we all need to pull together kind of thing.
Yeah, and Pumi was definitely kumbayaing. So you listened?
I listened. I listened. Well, I caught the podcast afterwards.
All right. Well, that's
Kent and somebody's got to do it.
But Pumi, I've got to correct something fundamental that you were doing last week that you were pushing on this whole private prosecution thing, and you were great for AfriForum. Big deal. And there's a crucial thing you have to understand about the conditions under which private prosecutions are allowed. You can't have a situation where AfriForum actually decides that they're going to arbitrarily take on cases like state capture cases. The conditions for private prosecution to happen mean that you have to get a buy-in from a person who is directly affected, and in the event of that person actually not being able to have their case taken to court. So like the family of the woman who was run over by Duduzane Zuma, and I hope he goes to jail for that, but that's the site. The family of the woman who got run over by Duduzane Zuma, they are in a position to do so. The woman who was attacked by Grace Mugabe, I hope she goes to jail for that. That's another example. So don't pick on AfriForum. They're good guys.
In other words, they need
You know what I love about this, Canton? The fact that if you are directly affected, you got to stand up and do something about it.
But you'll get help and now from NGOs.
It's not Kumbaya today. It's get up, stand up, stand up for your rights.
Okay.
Sia has been waiting for this week's reggae quote. Sia, there you have it. It came from Canton.
I'm going to try and herd the cats that we have here in the studio this morning by starting us off on Canton's topic of discussion on ENCA this week. It was an interesting debate. It's a show called Let's Have It Out. I haven't seen it before, but I watched it because I knew you were going to be on. Essentially, you were put in the position where you were the guy who was defending the tax revolt. It's not necessarily a position you occupy, but somehow you find yourself defending Helen Ziller's new call to hold tax back from this immoral government. What is your actual position before you get maligned by people who think that you're...
Firstly, I'm not an Mbongi for Helen Ziller, but I want to say something.
She doesn't know that.
I want to say something in her defense. And what I want to say in her defense is that if you read through her tweets, she never called for a tax revolt. She said, if the following things happen in the build-up to the elections and post-elections, and if there is no action in terms of what's going on around state capture, then we need to look at a tax revolt. So she's never actually called for a tax revolt.
Which is actually, by the way, a very reasonable position, considering the fact that she's not asking the impossible. She's asking that the NPA do their job.
Absolutely.
One of her conditions is if people vote for the ANC. Like, if we have a free and fair election...
Certainly from what I read, and I didn't read all of it, so this is open to criticism, and perhaps I need to go and pay more attention to Helen Ziller, which I'm happy to admit I don't. But what I saw was that she said, in the light of all of this corruption that's being uncovered by the State Capture Commission, her primary grievance is these people must be prosecuted.
Absolutely. We can all agree on that.
There must be an end game in sight from the point of view of someone being held responsible for what we're dealing with as a country. And I don't see that as an unreasonable point of view at all. If we're going to dig around for other things, sure, there may be stuff that I've missed. And Helen Ziller is not known for keeping her foot out of her mouth.
But again, what's kind of interesting, and this is one of those situations where if anyone other than Helen Ziller had said exactly the same thing, the world would have had no problem with it whatsoever.
And would have been calling them heroes and
absolutely,
the next leader
of that
of the,
kind of stuff. Yeah. But what was kind of interesting is, yes, I was put in the position where I'm ostensibly defending the whole idea of a tax revolt. But like most things this stuff has nuance. You know, it's got nothing to do with saying, yes, we should all tax revolt and we should withhold and topple the government and do treasonous stuff. Or actually, another point of view is, let's take our money and stick it into an escrow account until mm-hmm. such time as it's established that people are able to spend their money correctly, which is a form of a tax revolt, but it's not the same thing as saying that we're not going to pay money to support the government. We just want to wait.
Just by the way, if we did do that,
yes,
who would be the arbitrator or the mediator who would decide, okay, now we can release the funds?
Well, it's kind of difficult for us to do that for two reasons. Firstly, because SARS has access to our bank accounts.
So they just take money anyway.
So they'll take money anyway. So we don't have any way of actually setting up that scenario. But the way in which you can do a tax revolt is you can just simply refuse to get into high-paying jobs and just sit back on the sidelines and watch the economy actually go down without your skills. Ayn Rand spoke about that in Atlas Shrugged, you know, way before I was born. And it was exactly right. She was postulating exactly the scenario we've got in this country right now, where you have a corrupt government that keeps stealing. And so all of the people who actually had any sort of capability, you're talking about engineers, you're talking about doctors, they actually withheld their skills and started doing menial jobs. So you had astrophysicists who would now start flipping burgers at a McDonald's. Of course, McDonald's didn't exist back then, but you get the point. So they're not actually contributing their intellectual capital to uplifting the society.
I don't know that this government has any appreciation for those things. I don't think this government completely understands basic economics. I don't think they know why people buy and sell things, because they've mostly spent their lives in, certainly if you look at the last 24 years, a lot of these people have had sheltered employment. Guys who are making the decisions. I mean, I was talking about Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, who's sitting in a ministry. She's a minister. She gets paid a salary. I don't know what she's done for the last year that she's been in that office. And she's an example of someone who doesn't have to have an economic reality. She thinks doctors and street sweepers and domestic workers and astrophysicists are all really the same. They're just there to provide her with tax money. I don't think she has a full appreciation for this.
Yeah, you see, again, this
if you withhold your skills, she goes, so what?
You see, again, the situation is a bit more nuanced. And, you know, so as an example, I would say that if I was Cyril, I would rather have Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma as a minister in the presidency under my watchful eye rather than out there at Nkandla plotting my demise. So, you know, it's kind of insurance for him. So that's the reason why she's sitting there, rather than it being sheltered employment for her. What do you
it's
say
sheltered
for me?
Sheltered employment for him.
It's basically, yeah, it's almost like a new kind of nepotism.
Yes, well, you'd rather have the person in the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
All right, so
I think the one thing that we can all agree on with Helen Zille, with watching Gog Helen having her Twitter meltdown, is the fact that the DA is unable to bring this woman to heel.
I don't think she cares about the DA anymore. I don't think anyone cares about the DA anymore.
But what's happening with it? So all of her Twitter ramblings, right, have put them in this position where they are eating themselves inside.
Why do you obsess about the DA? Can we move on? I'd like to talk about important stuff.
Well, no, I'd like to draw a parallel between that and what Jacob Zuma is doing.
And the ANC. So the thing is, both these big parties are essentially collapsing onto themselves. And we're asking ourselves, who are we going to vote for? We're saying, why are young people not voting? Here the DA, which is trying
now,
to position
itself.
I've
told you for the past 4 weeks, start your own party. Until such time as you do that, you know, you must just chill, you know.
I don't have a problem with an individual in a party speaking out and even being stupid and even saying outrageous
things.
As far as I'm concerned, that is the whole purpose of social media. It reveals these people for what they really are. I don't care about party discipline. I'm not looking at the DA to be a moral exemplar or the ANC. I think these are broad churches that normally can't decide whether they're a teapot or a hockey stick anyway. So let the individuals inside them, that's what the ANC calls itself, let them say whatever they want to say. At least in this case, I'd far rather support Helen than the DA. I saw Musi Maimane came out against a tax revolt. I'm like, you know what, dude? You've just convinced me. I wasn't 100%. I was 90% there. Now I'm totally convinced that you don't care about the ordinary people of South Africa and the taxpayers in particular.
But he cares about Zimbabwe.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
What did he say?
Well, he's been having meetings with the opposition MDC and Zim.
No,
and,
shame.
Yeah.
Shame.
I'm making a masturbation hand gesture as we speak.
And I'm very perturbed by that gesture.
Sorry, Pumi. Is it offensive?
Very.
Pums, what's your position on the tax revolt then? Let's take Helen out of it. Canthan has made his position a little clearer than he did on the ENCA interview. How about yours?
My position on the tax revolt is that it's impossible to make it happen. I'm a realist and I'm a pragmatist, right? So if you're going to give me an idea, tell me how you're going to make that idea work. There is no way that Helen is going to be able, or anybody is going to be able, to pull off a tax revolt in this way, unless, as Kenton says, stop working. But then that the problem
suffers.
With stopping to work is like cutting off your nose to spite your face, right? Because now you don't have all of the things that you truly want. And SARS has into your bank account. SARS can get into your bank account. At work, before you even see the money, it's been taken.
Well, maybe,
so how are we going to make this thing work?
I have a possible practical idea? Let's take a leaf out of Bosasa's book and deal in the cash economy.
Who's to say that people are not already doing that?
That's what I'm thinking.
Exactly.
A lot of people already operate
so
in a cash economy.
So SARS don't know about that.
But the thing about operating in a cash economy is even then you can't get away from the tax because VAT.
Yeah, but that's only 15%. Personal income tax a whole lot more. We can at least avoid that. I mean, let's start dealing in cash. People find a way. Isn't it interesting? Like there's a certain... There's a curve they talk about with a tax threshold where people reach an optimal level of what they're prepared to pay. And after that, they start being – they start finding ways of less lawful ways of doing business.
Yes. Generally, what happens is that when the tax person climbs in – you see that I was very politically correct, not to say tax man – climbs in and starts to impose things that are unreasonable, then people actually bypass it. So cigarettes are a prime example where we've had outrageous taxes on cigarettes for the longest time. And so what happens is that because the cost of the cigarettes is so minimal compared to the amount of tax that you pay for it, you have illegal cigarettes flooding the country and tax revenue drops. And that is a tax revolt, effectively.
And so ironically, some of that illicit cigarette money goes back into politics.
Exactly.
Into whose hands, Konja?
Well, if we're led to believe the headlines that we see about Mazzotti, it could be in Julius's hands. It might be funding the EFF as we speak.
Yes, but it's all in cash, so we'd never know, will we?
We would never know. That's my point, is that there are ways and means. You don't necessarily have to be an absolutist on either side of this argument, but you can certainly find ways of throttling your own flows into the treasury.
You know, earlier you were talking about centrists. Yes. That's what America is lacking. But that's what South Africans tend to be. You know, we don't like the super polarized. We're nice people. You know, we're looking for some mild-mannered ways of dealing with the issues that are facing us.
Yeah, most people are not revolutionaries or reactionaries. Most people are somewhere in between. They just want to have their happy family lives and try and give their kids the best opportunities and all that kind of thing. I think we go down some already charted territory here. Let's move on to something else that I think everybody wants to talk about. What do you two think of nationalizing the Reserve Bank? That's Pumi's response. Yours, Kevin?
Well, the interesting thing is that the Reserve Bank is already owned by the people of South Africa. It's just that its independence is guaranteed in our constitution. Can we actually just put this in perspective? The current discussion that's going on right now is not about nationalizing. It's about actually removing the handful of private shareholders that actually provide oversight. Now, let's be very clear that those private shareholders that we have on the Reserve Bank don't control the Reserve Bank, and they don't actually make money from the Reserve Bank.
And they don't appoint the governor.
And they don't appoint the governor.
Or the deputy governor.
Yes, but what they do is they do exercise oversight in the sense of if the Reserve Bank is wanting to turn around and do something that is outside of its mandate, and fundamentally the mandate of the Reserve Bank is to protect the currency against inflation. Fundamentally, if we want to get down to brass tacks, That's what we it's meant to prevent a situation where we have runaway hyperinflation like we did in Zimbabwe, where the Zim dollar is now, well, yeah, the Zim dollar. Yeah, trillions and trillions
of Zim dollars. There are children who've never heard of such a thing.
Yes. Well, inflation basically is a scenario where the government, well, in this case, the Reserve Bank, ends up printing money at a faster rate than economic growth. And when that happens, that's when you get inflation, because you see, your economic growth determines the value of what your country is all about. But if you print money at a faster rate, so if your economy grows at 2% and if your money supply grows at 5%, then the value of the money is obviously less, because you get you have 5% of cash notes sitting out there that is now actually paying for only 3% of growth. And that means that you're actually getting less value for your money. And if the Reserve Bank was able to do that by just simply arbitrarily printing money, can you imagine?
It's pantomime money.
Yes, yes.
So that's what it is.
Well, all money is pantomime money at the end of the day, except for gold.
I mean, Zimbabwe, luckily for Zimbabwe, they have a neighbor like us. But the last time something like that in the world, the scale of it, the kind of...
Venezuela, guys.
Venezuela
is a modern day example of this absurdity.
Well, let's save that for a minute, because I like your explanation of how the Reserve Bank works, but there is still this concern, and maybe it's being raised by people who find it politically expedient, because anything that's held in private hands is looked at suspiciously by certain people in government.
Well, the reason why it's being looked at right now is because it actually came out of NASREC. And fundamentally, this was something that was put on the table at NASREC, and it was adopted as part of a bundle of resolutions. Look, I've no doubt that there are significant chunks of people within the ANC who think that this is an absurdity. But
Tito Mboweni thinks it's an absurdity.
Absolutely.
And he thinks this is remember, he was governor of the Reserve Bank.
Yes.
So there's no one in the ANC with a more intimate knowledge of how it works.
Well, Jill Marcus as well was also in a similar position. But, and Lesetsha Kanyako, our current Reserve Bank.
Who seems to be a very competent guy.
I rate the guy. He's highly competent.
But
and
the
of course,
thing about
he
it
came
though,
from the Trevor Manuel School, though, which is a bit of a swear word.
But the thing about it, guys, is that there is a level of not understanding the fundamentals of what you're talking about. That's the crux of the matter, is not quite understanding what it is that you're talking about. And so when you say political expedience, and the buzzwords are all there. The buzzwords are private hands. The buzzwords are few people. Those buzzwords. And if you understand, and Kenton took us through what it looks like, the people who are on the ground voting a couple of weeks ago in NASREC, if you think about what those people and the collective consciousness of those individuals sitting in that NASREC, you saw it. There were like thousands of people there, and you're like, some of them are like your uncle and your aunt, and if we sitting here have a tip of the iceberg view of what it is that the Reserve Bank actually does, mm-hmm. or how it works.
Can you imagine how uneducated they are about it?
And what the so those decisions and those resolutions coming out of those masses and masses of branches of the broader church, you called it earlier, is what we have is we have what we read in the media, which is superficial at best.
And
superficial at best.
And clickbait a lot of the time, let's be fair.
And so what that has done is it's created this momentum and frenzy around this thing, which is why when you say, what do you think of the Reserve Bank? My big thing is just to sigh. It's going to be a thing that in another 3 years...
Just one more thing I must say about private shareholders, by the way. One of the things that Kanyako did after he got in there was to actually invite members of the public to also become private shareholders. And... again, he set up criteria that was really meant to broaden the base so that you can have a greater diversity in terms of the private shareholders that are actually there. And I think that that's a good thing. That's the route that we should be going. We shouldn't be handing control of it. Well, government currently has control over it, but we shouldn't be reducing the oversight that happens within the Reserve Bank. We should be increasing it.
If the last 9 years are anything, it's a lesson in that we need to expand oversight in government, not reduce it by individuals and by private entities.
Just be clear that these are not 9 wasted years.
Yes, now, Jacob Zuma will have us believe that they were very good years, that he was a great steward for this country.
And yes, he benefited fulsomely from it, and well done.
Let's talk about Venezuela. You raised it as an example of hyperinflation. There are lots of things that are being said about Venezuela at the moment, and the usual old tropes are being trotted out. I received a video from a friend of mine who's a big lefty, who's a big Maduro fan, who says, well, this is just another example of imperialism, as if the US have sent troops that are waiting to invade Venezuela for their oil wealth. Like that's a thing. If they'd managed to exploit that oil wealth up to now to the extent that they tried to when Hugo Chavez was still president, sure, there might be a different story in Venezuela. The fact is, it's a disaster. There are 2.3 million Venezuelans living outside the borders of Venezuela at the moment, some of them dying of starvation in refugee camps. It's an unprecedented crisis for South America, to the extent that only two other South American countries are even supporting Maduro at the moment. But it's all about the US and their imperialism to the left. And to the right, it's the poster child of how socialism can go wrong. So what is it?
You know, I have mixed feelings on this. You know, I hate Venezuelan socialism with a passion. You know, I cannot tell you the disdain that I have for Hugo Chavez. So, I mean, his daughter is now a dollar billionaire, and which is generally the pattern in these countries, where money is stolen from the masses and goes directly into the pockets of the family. So it's like Isabella dos Santos in
Angola.
In Angola. It's like Mugabe's family in Zimbabwe. So
Obiang Nguema's,
you know, so I think we can all agree. Guinea, yeah. I think we can all agree without hesitation that these guys are bad, and the Venezuelans actually deserve better. But at the same time, I'm very wary of U.S.'s attempts at regime change, because that always ends in disaster. We just need to take a look at what went down in Chile as a result of the CIA toppling Salvador Allende and installing Pinochet, setting in place a reign of terror that lasted, but close on 20 years, mm-hmm. You know, where the body count was phenomenal, and that was
backed by
the U.S. Yes,
you can look at the assassination
of
sure?
The assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, U.S. backed regime change. The installation of the Shah in Iran, again U.S. backed regime change. The disaster that is currently happening in terms of Libya. So, do I believe that they need a change of government? Yes. Do I believe that there should be any military intervention that forces a change? No, not at all.
But I don't know that that's even on the cards at the moment. I mean, there's certainly a lot of hawkish people in America who talk this game all the time.
Yes.
Yeah. And it would be a great distraction for President Trump from his domestic problems.
Well, what is true and is that can, is yeah, that yeah. The U.S. does end up funding insurgent groups on the side and giving so these guys out in Syria who call themselves the White Helmets, mm-hmm. Who are actually a bunch of ISIS thugs, but they're carrying guns that are supplied by the U.S. in an attempt to destabilize the Assad regime. Now, again, Assad is a piece of work. You know, he's used weapons on his own people. But right now, in the interest of stability in that country, it's probably the best possible thing to actually just leave him there and to tell him that, you know, if you try picking on Israel, then we're going to bomb you. And that keeps things cool.
It's not like things are great in Syria anyway. He's got to pick up a lot of pieces. So just let him get on with it.
Exactly.
Okay.
People should be allowed to govern or misgovern themselves.
As we do.
We've been ruining ourselves by voting horrible people into office for a long time now. And let's just pay attention quickly to what is going on within Venezuela before we pay too much attention to what's going on without. I think you've covered a lot of that ground for us already. So we've got Maduro, then we've got this Guaido, who is the guy who proclaimed himself president on the street,
who's now been told he's not allowed to leave.
Like, that's a legitimate process in itself. I mean, there are lots of questions here, but I think people are attaching whatever parts of this story they like to their own idealist view of what should and could and must and would have, could or should have happened. The truth is, though, that it's really just a mess. Whoever ends up president's going to have so much work to do. If it is Maduro and he carries on, and by the way, he's been making some noises about let's get together, let's talk, let's try to figure this out, which he wasn't doing before, which might be a progress of a kind. What do we think of what's actually going on inside the country? How did we get to this point?
Well, we got to this point in exactly the same way that Saudi Arabia is at their particular point right now. Let me explain what I mean by that. Both of those countries actually made their money based on oil. And remember, we had a situation where the price of oil went well over $100 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And during that time, you know, those were the heydays for all of these places. But so the Saudis were spending money based on the fact that oil was at that price, and the Venezuelans were doing actually the same thing. So Hugo Chavez was able to take the profits and to pour it into distributing largesse among his people. Then the price of oil plummeted because of fracking. So right. Fracking then drove down the price of oil back down to round about the $50 to $60 a barrel price range. So at that point, the Saudis got an absolute fright, and they decided to drive the frackers out of the market. So the Saudis pushed down the price of oil back to around about the $40 a barrel range. And the idea was to kill the fracking industry because they had made substantial investments in infrastructure and in sinking new wells. And fracking is not sustainable below the $50 a barrel mark. So now that the Saudis very successfully managed to drive a lot of the incumbent frackers out of the market, but it cost them because obviously their revenue plummeted as a result. It cost the Russians big time, but the Russians are a lot smarter because the Russians have always based their budget at the $40 a barrel price point for oil. So everything that they get over $40 a barrel, Putin
bonus.
Has just been banking, and he's been banking in the sense of buying gold. Mm-hmm. He's been reducing his dependence on the U.S. dollar, whereas Chavez and now Maduro and the Saudis, they
didn't have a plan B.
They don't have a plan B, and that's the reason why they're stuck where they are right now. So the only thing that can save Maduro is if you have a dramatic increase in the price of oil. And
ironically, you know, a U.S. campaign for Guaido would do exactly that.
Yes, exactly.
So that's an interesting.
Except we don't trust the U.S.
Irony. No. Well, you know what? I mean, do we trust Maduro? I mean, the guy has sat there and watched as the country's fallen apart under him without any, as you say, plan B, and certainly any intention of changing.
But like Zuma,
policy.
He knows how to dance. Have you seen those videos? Yes, yes. Follow his account on Twitter. He does two things. He posts dancing videos, and he posts videos of him inspecting his armed forces.
Okay.
Yes.
So we're clearly dealing with someone who's of a kind.
Yes.
Remind ourselves that Hugo Chavez was the hero of a certain Julius Malema for some time.
Mm.
I don't hear Julius Malema talking
Hugo
too much
Chavez
about...
Hugo Chavez is also the hero of Jeremy Corbyn in
England.
In England, yes.
But I don't hear either of them really talking too much about Venezuela anymore.
No.
It's become a less popular topic of conversation than it was when the oil price was high. I wonder why.
Mm.
I wonder why...
Short attention spans.
I wonder why so many people in the US who are on the left aren't talking so much about Venezuela. Where's Sean Penn now?
To stay alive.
Where are these people who have so much praise? I mean, wasn't Bernie Sanders someone who used to dance around proclaiming the amazing
I don't remember Sanders.
Virtues of,
I don't remember Sanders actually singing the virtues of
I think
Venezuela.
He was a fan of Hugo Chavez for some time. So I don't hear much noise from him either. I just want to point it out. Okay, let's get back to South Africa and everybody's favorite story at the moment. The chaos that is being revealed in Bosasa. I mean, Gavin Watson with his prayer meetings every morning was also dishing out bags of cash, including Dudu Mieni got 300,000 rand in a Louis Vuitton bag.
Well, that's his claim, isn't it? I mean, we've yet to actually see the actual audit trail that says that. And, of course, the useful thing about going before the commission is that the fact that you say something under oath doesn't necessarily mean that it's true.
Or that it's provable.
Yes.
Places like Louis Vuitton and those things, they take all of your details when you buy their things so that you can come back and say, you know what, my bag was stolen.
Is a brilliant point.
so we can go to the shop.
Why yes. is nobody producing this invoice, this receipt for this
point.
Bag?
Because if we had bag, we could suppose the cash.
This guy remembers everything. Thing, including like the color of underwear people were wearing, and then all of a sudden some things he just can't remember. I just can't remember that. Like there are just too many holes in this guy's story.
It's impossible that all of this happened, or do you think some of it is impossible? I mean, this seems to me this is something we haven't considered.
Look, all of the stuff that plays itself, you know, again, we take everything that goes out there as gospel. And remember that everything that goes before all of these various commissions still has to be investigated by the NPA, who have to build a compelling case and then take it to court and then end up prosecuting people. So until such time, I tend to be very skeptical about what's actually going on out here, because it might very well be false flag operations that are actually deflecting attention from people who are really behind the scenes. So I'm skeptical. But,
the smoke and mirrors
of it all.
But is
it a lovely soap opera? Yes, I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
But we do know that Bosasa have got so many contracts from correctional services inter alia.
Absolutely.
Over the last couple of years, to the tune of some hundreds of millions.
Yes.
Every time. And it does seem suspicious to me that although those tenders were probably, in terms of paperwork, gone through properly, we all know how tenders work. Sometimes it's decided long before the tender process is even undertaken. If indeed people have been bribed with boxes of meat and expensive liquor, and there have been Louis Vuitton bags stuffed with cash, which wouldn't be outside of the scope of possibility if you believe Gabisi Jonas about what the Guptas offered him. If any of that is true, shouldn't the NPA be making moves to assure South Africa that if this stuff's true, we're going to find out and we're going to prosecute?
I think that, the prosecution...
Wouldn't that be the prudent thing to
do?
Well,
I think the prosecution authority in any country actually needs to build its case behind the scenes and not actually telegraph what it's doing.
Mm.
Okay. Let's be very clear about that. So, obviously, we haven't seen anything from our new National Director of Public Prosecutions yet that would make us want to stand up and dance. But at the same time, do you want her to be telling people, by the way,
we're investigating you
at this point? I don't think so.
I had an interesting interview with, what's the guy's name at the SIU, at the Special Investigations Unit? And he was talking about how... New Dawn. He was talking about how change has come into the unit, how they're out there, they're putting together cases, and they've got so much more, they've got so much hope with this new rebuilding of the NPA, and that they've got, and just listening to him speak, I thought, oh, this guy, you know, there's such renewed energy for his job.
Let's take him at his word. If that happens, Canton's probably right. It's better to keep quiet and go about your investigations without telling people you're coming after them.
You know, I would love to see, because the internet, right? We're always watching Vice videos and now this videos and all of those kind of debunking myths and all of that. You know what I'd love to see? Is I'd love to see somebody, one of these news agencies, putting 300,000 rands in a Louis Vuitton bag. I would love to see somebody just packing that money. You know, just... whether it's 200 rand,
easily get 300,000.
Yeah, ENCA actually did that, and
where's this video? Why is it not trending?
They didn't put 300,000 in. They created a visual where it looked like there was 300,000.
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, if you sold the whole of ENCA, you can get 300,000 rand. But let's just put that aside. I've seen 300,000 rand in cash.
Oh, that's so
you have seen 300,000.
I've seen a lot more than that. You would easily be able to put 300,000 rand into a bag. The reason I've seen it, I went to the Reserve Bank. I saw them destroying old notes.
Yes,
which they've exactly, you know, right. It's hundreds of millions of rands that get put through a machine that chops them into tiny pieces and gets thrown out with the rest of the trash. But the fact is, a 300,000 rand will easily fit into a handbag.
The more interesting question for me, though,
200 rand notes, easy.
You know, the starting point for me in terms of Bosasa would actually to go after the auditors. Because on the assumption that you actually have external auditors, which, you know, nearly every company in this country,
well, it's, you know, if you're a fiduciary,
you have to have external auditors. It's really difficult to conceal so much cash going out from your bottom line, really. And having, you know, myself for the past, you know, God knows how many years being director of companies myself and having to sign off on financial statements and needing to sit through all of the probing with the auditors, burying cash in a company is really a difficult thing to do because, you know, on the assumption that money is transferred to you from the state, and there's going to be a discrepancy in terms of how that money is spent internally and how it ends up in the form of cash. So I would go after the auditors.
But what do we know about auditors?
Well, but that's the point, because what we do know about auditors is they're going to say, oops, we made a mistake and here's your money back. And by the way, we're shutting down our South African division.
KPMG.
Exactly.
So there are costs. There are actual costs to an auditing firm that lies.
Yes.
Whereas to government, there aren't always.
Exactly. And that's why I would say that the starting point for us would be to say, who are BOSASA's auditors? And I haven't actually investigated this myself because, frankly, I've been too busy watching the soap opera to think about what the next step is. But I'd like to know who are the auditors, and maybe someone will call in and tell us who the auditors are.
Kenton, and therein lies the danger with what we're seeing with BOSASA and we're seeing with the commission, is that it actually is so compelling just to watch this whole thing unfolding, that, and that's where the smoke and mirrors lie, right? Is it simply such a distraction? Is we're all so busy being shocked at all these revelations, is that the stuff that we should be thinking about?
Is this true?
Is we're not. You know what I also am forever wondering? Who is sitting there watching this thing all the time? When you look on Twitter, why are these people not working?
Have huge unemployment, Pumi.
but this is the thing that fascinates me, is that we do have huge unemployment, but the people that you see talking about, tweeting about, being so engrossed in all of this stuff is people who are supposedly, you know, have the money for the data. So the people that are sitting in the hood, on the street corners, are not the people watching this. And this is also the biggest number of people that are sitting there as voters, but the people who should be working. I'm like, why aren't you working? Damn it.
Well, you can actually work and watch at the same time. You
know, what the hell are you doing in your job?
Some of us are able to multitask that way.
That's fascinating, but I don't want to go down that road for the moment. I want to ask you something of you, Kenton. You mentioned that this could be, let's imagine, conspiracy theory take hold. Let's imagine it's a false flag operation of some kind. Let's take it to that that length of speculation. Who would benefit from such a thing? Who are the immediate benefactors of such a false flag operation?
Well, the people who actually receive the money. And as to who that is, I'm not going to speculate because obviously that ends up becoming defamatory. But I think that if we want to actually try and connect all of the dots in this...
So these would be sacrificial lambs?
Exactly.
Completely.
Exactly.
It's a big sacrificial lamb.
But if you consider
that means the amount of money that really has gone. I mean, we had JJ Tabani in here the other day, and he was saying he thinks this is just the tip of the iceberg, which kind of plays into what you're saying in some way, that actually we're not even uncovering the real.
Yes, Dudu Mieni doesn't matter anymore because, you know, she was.
So she's expendable.
She's expendable. You know, she was JZ's.
Fat woman.
Well, whatever. I mean, but she can go down now because, you know, JZ is no longer in power and there's no interest in keeping her there.
So, by the way, her defense against any of these allegations is that, oh, well, dismiss Agritzi. He's a bitter, angry racist.
Yes.
He may be all those things, but he may also be telling the truth.
Well, now he has self-confessed all those things.
Yeah, he said he's... Does it bother us that this evidence might be coming from a racist?
Well, again, if you consider that you first have Agritzi coming up with all of this stuff, then suddenly it turns out that he's a racist.
Yes.
And guess what? Okay, the entire credibility of his testimony now gets called into play, and the objective has been achieved. You've successfully distracted people around the stuff. Then you dismiss all of his claims on the basis that he's a racist, because we all know that the race card trumps every other card.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly all of the stuff just gets washed away.
Hmm. So there is something suspicious going on here, at very least. Let's see what the NPA
does. I tend to be suspicious of everyone.
I like that about you. Are there any other matters that have arisen this week that you think are worthy of our attention this morning?
Guys, why are we not having a conversation about Jacob Zuma's Twitter account? Who is running that Twitter account?
I think he's doing it himself.
Really?
I don't think he has a staff for that. If he does, he's far more Machiavellian than any of us had ever supposed before.
I absolutely think that he's got somebody running that thing. Have you seen him do a selfie? No. Somebody's out there taking all of those videos.
So he's not doing what all of us would do and say, here, hold this camera. like here, hold my beer.
Like Sia would. Like Sia would just, excuse me, Mr. Wayne, take my picture. No.
So
somebody is running this Twitter account.
To what? For what purpose?
This is, and therein is the real question. So all of the stuff that is being put out there and the timing around it all is so fascinating for me, because it's, you know, so he resigns and says, we'll see you all sometime soon, right?
That's what he said.
He's gone. Yeah. And now he's gone, and then nothing for almost a year. And then, boom, this whole thing starts a Twitter account. It's like, hello world, look at me. It starts out innocuous. It's a couple of, you know, tweets. I'm getting music into this thing. Let's talk here. It's going to be music. And then, boom. You know, it's like schooling Fikile Mbalula. It's like, you know, long tweets here about 9 wasted years. This thing is thought out. This thing is strategic. This thing is being mapped out at every level. And he's not doing it alone. So, and then as Kenton says, who are the real puppet masters? Who are the real benefactors of all of this?
Well, let's not forget that it's still very possible for money to be flowing from Dubai to pay for a, shall we say, a social media management team to actually work with JZ and ensure that particular messages get put out on a regular basis. I mean, Bell Pottinger, the fact that they have officially withdrawn from this account doesn't mean that you can't actually replace them with someone else who is actually capable of doing the same thing.
And what's the worst possible outcome for Jacob Zuma and the Guptas is that they actually end up being prosecuted. So anything they can do to prevent that would be a win.
Absolutely.
And that would include troublemaking.
Yes.
Guys, and I'm just saying that the level of politics of this man, you know, the level of politics.
Oh, no,
He totally knows how to play this game. So when he tweets, just the timing of Cyril in Davos and making all of his statements about, and Jacob Zuma is not wrong, guys. He is simply saying that there is another side to this coin. There's all of this talk on the one hand about all of the terrible things that have happened, but there are also all of these good things that have happened. We are now all in our feels about the fact that Jacob Zuma is saying, but look at AIDS and the rolling out of antiretrovirals, look at this and look at that. We're all in our feels going, this guy, how dare he only talk about the good stuff? But we're not saying, Cyril, how dare you only talk about the bad stuff? Really, guys?
As if you weren't part of it.
Really, guys?
Yeah.
So if what's good for the goose has got to be good for the gander. If he's going to only talk about the bad stuff, then let him be allowed to talk about the good stuff too, because it's in his interest. It's in his interest to say, look at all of the good stuff that we did. And isn't that what politicians do? Politicians come out in an election year and they say, ha-ha, look at all the good stuff we're doing.
Well,
they don't say, look at all of the stuff that we haven't managed to do.
I think between you and Canton this morning, I feel like I'm looking at this from a whole different point of view. I thought I had it all figured out, but I'm going to admit straight up, I'm now starting to think that I might have had it all wrong on both counts. The Zuma Twitter account and the account of what's going on at Bisasa at the moment. I think there's a lot more to it than we think.
And it's just,
Pass on this podcast to everybody you know.
We don't know how to.
Jesus, if you wanted some controversy on your Thursday morning, you've got it right here. Forget about what's in the news.
Can this we talk Zimbabwe for a
second? This is the
second
subtext. Okay, yes, of course.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, dear. So Zim, of course, you know, we've been seeing the images coming out of the country, and it's been, you know, the same old that's been going on for the past few years. And we had a fairly heated discussion at home last night in terms of you know, what should be happening in Zim. And my take on it was fundamentally that the army is still in charge in Zimbabwe. So this is exactly the situation like we have in Myanmar, where Aung San Suu Kyi is the leader of the party, but she absolutely has no say whatsoever in the military running the country. So all of those atrocities that got perpetrated in terms of the massacres of certain groups of people in parts of the country, she had absolutely nothing to do with it. But more to the point, she has no ability whatsoever to stop it. So,
and in fact, the military junta have been very smart about that, because they make her look like she's responsible.
Exactly.
They don't have to take responsibility.
And so now we've got the same situation in Zimbabwe, where the crocodile is outside of the country and he's trying desperately to actually set up deals that are going to rebuild the economy of the country. Meanwhile, you have the MDC, which seizes the moment and says, actually, let's go out and protest. Let's understand what triggered the protest. What triggered the protest was the fact that they had to double the price of fuel. Why do they have to double the price of fuel? Because they ran out of money. Hmm. And in order to keep the country running, when you have something that's in short supply, the proper thing to do is to actually raise the price, not to ration it, because we've all seen where rationing ends up. It ends up with lines and the country no longer works. But on the other hand, if you actually push up the price, businesses that depend on the fuel are still going to pay it, but at least the country keeps ticking over. But obviously people get hugely upset. They take to the streets and protest. But unlike our country, where you know you can run through the streets of Cape Town and smash shop windows with impunity, if you try doing that kind of stuff in downtown Harare, the army is going to come down on your sorry ass and damn. I would not pull that shit.
So am I to distill from this that you actually think what has happened there is just what needed to happen there?
No, I'm saying that there's no alternative. You know, let's be very clear about that. Okay, you know, everyone says that you can put down a rebellious mob in gentler ways. Yeah, that's probably true. But they've never been schooled in those gentler ways.
No, this is the army. They're not politicians.
This is the army. They're not politicians. It's not police force.
They have only one lever.
So, you know, this is the reason why my good friend Helen Ziller has called for the army to be deployed in the Cape Flats townships, I would say, are you out of your mind? Because you never allow the army into civilian life, because that way lies the terror that we see happening in every country in the world, where you allow the army to actually be turned upon its own populace. Point around armies is to defend the country from external aggression. And, you know, we have a very kind of jaded view on that. But if you want to know why we shouldn't be doing it in this country, just take a look at what's happening in Zim. But again, you know, the question, to go back to the point about Mnangagwa, I'm not saying that that's what needed to be done. What I'm saying is, guys, what is the alternative right now? The country is out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the process by which he's going about rebuilding that economy, if you look to the north of the country, they've discovered oil that he's signed a deal with the Australians, who are now going to set up ways of actually extracting that oil, which is going to be a source of revenue. But that's only going to start paying off in about 5 to 10 years time.
10 years.
Because these are long-term investments. So what is South Africa doing to actually help? I think that what should be happening right now is that Ramaphosa should be having serious discussions with the guy about actually pulling that country into the Rand monetary area.
That would be interesting. Sure, there's a lot to chew on this morning. Thank you, Pumi. Thank you, Canton. Wow, but
Gareth, are you feeling overwhelmed by life today?
No, I love this. This is the stuff that
Sia's been quiet this morning, by the way.
You're not gonna.
You see, this is the thing. This is what I was telling you about our young people today. Is what with the serious discussions are happening when you have to engage it. You just
no. To be fair,
check out Sia.
Sia's just being polite. He's probably got lots of things to say.
As he blinks his eyes.
Listen, thank you both. That was fascinating. Honestly, one of the best burning platforms I've ever been witness to. So pass this on to anybody who thinks they've figured it out. Very, very interesting stuff. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. We return next Thursday. Same time, same place. Don't miss it or you will miss out.
This is CliffCentral.com.